Ekatra Podcast Conversations, the curious essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome to this deep dive. Mm-hmm. Today we are tackling something, well, massive. Arnold Toynbee's hit, A Study of History.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't just one book, is it? It's a 12-volume effort written over, 30 years, trying to make sense of the whole human story.
It's genuinely monumental and honestly a bit intimidating for most people. You hear the name Toynbee, but grappling with the full theory, that's rare.
Right. So our mission today for you, the listener, is really to give you a shortcut. We're not going to drown you in dates or battle names.
No, definitely not. We're hunting for what Toynbee saw as the universal operating system, the underlying code that governs how civilizations are born, how they live, and ultimately how they fall apart.
We want that fundamental recipe. What allows a society to thrive? And just as importantly, what causes its ultimate failure? He wasn't just charting Rome's decline. He was after a pattern, wasn't he? A kind of formula.
He really was. And he pinpointed one central dynamic, like an engine driving history forward. Challenge and response.
Challenge and response.
That's the absolute key. If you grasp that phrase, you basically understand, I'd say, 90% of Toynbee's massive work. It explains everything from the earliest cultures right up to the collapse of huge empires.
Okay, that sounds incredibly powerful. A single unifying idea.
Yeah.
But let's back up a bit. Who was Arnold Joseph Toynbee? He lived from 1889 to 1975. What gave him the perspective to even attempt something this huge?
Well, what makes him so distinct is this kind of dual expertise he had. On the one hand, he was just steeped in classical history, you know, the Hellenic world, ancient Greece and Rome.
Okay, so the deep academic grounding.
Exactly. That gave him a perfect sort of contained case study, an entire civilization birthed to death.
But he wasn't just stuck in a library, was he? Reading old texts.
Not at all. And this is crucial. He worked directly for the British Foreign Office. He served through both world wars. Yeah, and he spent decades involved with the Royal Institute of International Affairs. So he wasn't just studying history. He was living through what he called a time of troubles for his own Western civilization. He saw the chaos of the 20th century up close.
So how did that practical experience, seeing those crises firsthand, actually shape his academic work? Did it make him approach history differently than other scholars, give him more urgency?
Oh, absolutely. It gave him this profound urgency to find these big macro patterns, maybe find ways to predict or even prevent future catastrophes. You have to remember, back then, a lot of history was really focused narrowly, right, on the nation state.
The history of England or the history of France?
Precisely. Toynbee just rejected that. He thought it was too limited. He dared to compare globally across civilizations. He pulled together knowledge from like 24 different cultures, Chinese, Indian, Mayan, Andean, Western. You name it.
That's incredible scope.
It was his life's work, trying to weave it all into one coherent theory.
Okay, so let's dig into that theory, the core mechanism. You mentioned he rejected the nation state. Why was focusing on the civilization so critical for him?
Because he argued the nation state just doesn't make sense on its own. It's unintelligible in isolation. It's like trying to understand your heart without knowing anything about the rest of your body.
Okay.
Britain, France, Germany. They only make sense, he said, as parts of this bigger thing. Western civilization, that was the organism he wanted to track. The intelligible unit of study, he called it.
And he found about, 21 to 23 of these major organisms throughout history. So if they are like organisms, they must follow some kind of life cycle, right?
Yeah.
A predictable path.
That's exactly his point. There's a trajectory. It starts with Genesis, birth. Which, crucially, always happens in difficult circumstances. It's driven by that challenge and response dynamic we mentioned.
Okay, birth through struggle. Then what?
Then comes growth. And this growth is sustained by continually meeting new challenges with creative solutions. This leads to an internal shift he called etherealization. We'll definitely need to unpack that one.
Etherealization.
Okay.
And the final act, the one we always focus on.
The inevitable breakdown and disintegration. This happens, he argues, when that creative spark fails internally. The society basically collapses from within.
So his goal is to give you, the learner, a framework. So when you look at all the messy stuff of history, the wars, the famines, the revolutions, you can actually see, this civilization is in this particular phase.
Exactly. It brings a kind of structure to the apparent chaos.
Let's zoom in on the beginning then, Genesis and growth. Toynbee was really clear, wasn't he? Civilizations don't just pop up where life is easy. He tossed out ideas about race or perfect geography being the cause.
Absolutely. He basically said, look, if you live in some tropical paradise with fruit falling off the trees, you just stagnate.
Too easy. No push.
Right. Civilizations only spark into life when they face and overcome a challenge of the golden mean. It has to be tough enough to force creativity and effort, but not so crushing that it wipes them out immediately.
That perfect sweet spot of pressure. You need the grit in the oyster to make the pearl. He used examples, right? Like Egypt.
Yeah, Egypt is a classic Toynbee example. It didn't arise from easy living. It came from mastering the incredibly demanding Nile Valley, this fertile strip surrounded by deadly desert. They had to innovate, cooperate, just to survive the encroaching dryness.
And the Andean civilizations, too, in South America.
Same idea. Mastering a really harsh, high-altitude, pretty sterile environment, their success was a direct result of how hard their initial challenge was.
Okay, so they meet the challenge, they survive, they start to grow.
Hmm?
But then you get to his idea of growth, and it gets, well, kind of controversial. He says expansion, like building a huge empire, isn't necessarily growth.
Right, that's what throws people off, because we usually measure historical success by, you know, how much land did they conquer? How big was the empire?
Yeah. Exactly. Roads, legions, provinces.
Yeah.
That looks like success. Toynbee calls it stagnation. How?
Because for him, true growth is etherealization. It's an internal shift. It's about becoming more refined, more spiritual. A growing civilization shifts its main energy away from just mastering the external world, conquering neighbors, getting more resources.
Okay, stuff?
Yeah, more stuff. And instead focuses inward on self-mastery, on cultural development, on philosophical or spiritual depth. So a society could have amazing technology, incredible weapons, but if its culture is shallow or its ethics are decaying, for Toynbee, that's not growth. It's actually a sign of failure setting in.
Okay, that reframes things completely.
Yeah.
It's about the quality of the inner life, not the quantity of external power.
Hmm.
And who drives this internal progress?
It's driven, he says, by a small group. The creative minority. These are the inspired leaders, the visionaries.
And then the rest of society, the majority.
The majority follows them, but, and this is key, they follow through voluntary imitation. He calls it mimesis. It's voluntary because the leaders are genuinely inspiring. They offer solutions that resonate, that work. People want to follow them.
It's leadership by attraction, not force. And these creative types often follow a pattern he noticed. Withdrawal and return.
Yes. He saw this recurring theme. The leader, or potential leader, needs to step back from the immediate problem, withdraw from the, you know, the noise of society.
Go into the wilderness,
yeah.
Literally or figuratively.
Exactly. To wrestle with the challenge, find enlightenment, find the creative solution in solitude. Then they return to lead the society forward with this new vision. He points to figures like Jesus or the Buddha, Muhammad. They all fit this pattern. Solitude fuels the breakthrough.
Which leads us, inevitably, to the breakdown. The breakdown and disintegration phase. And this, you said, is maybe the most powerful part of his theory because it's so focused on internal responsibility.
It really is. Toynbee is absolutely emphatic on this point. Civilizations are not murdered. They commit suicide.
Wow. Okay, unpack that because right. It feels like, well, sometimes civilizations are murdered, right? Invading hordes. Overwhelming force.
Toynbee would argue those external forces, the Huns, the Vikings, whoever, they're always kind of circling. They only succeed when the civilization has already hollowed itself out from the inside. The real failure is internal first. It's a failure of creativity, a failure of spirit.
So the breakdown starts when that creative minority
loses its touch.
Exactly. They lose their creative spark. They can only offer old answers to new problems, formulaic responses. They stop inspiring people.
And when that inspiration dries up, they change, don't they? They don't just disappear.
No, they degrade. They become a merely dominant minority. They stop ruling through that voluntary mimesis, through inspiration, and they start ruling by, well, force. Coercion, bureaucracy, control, weapons and rules replace allegiance and vision.
And when force becomes the main tool, the whole society starts to crack apart.
That's what he calls the schism in the body social. This long, slow period of decay sets in. The unity is gone.
And society fragments into predictable groups. Three main ones, yeah. You've got the dominant minority at the top, the now uncreative rulers clinging to power. Then you have the internal proletariat. These are the masses within the civilization's borders who feel alienated, disenfranchised, resentful. They no longer feel like they belong.
The people the system has left behind, essentially.
Precisely. And finally, you have the external proletariat. These are the barbarians, the outsiders, the people living beyond the frontiers, who are now sensing the weakness and waiting for their chance.
Okay, so the body is sick, fractured.
Yeah.
And this long decay produces some characteristic final institutions, right? Like attempts to stop the bleeding.
Yes. Three main products emerge from this disintegration phase. First, the dominant minority often tries to impose order with a universal state.
Like the Roman Empire for the Greco-Roman world. Centralized control and the civil wars.
Exactly. It imposes order, which might seem like a good thing. But Toynbee sees it as a symptom of late-stage decay. An Indian summer, he called it. It provides structure, yes, but the creative vitality is gone. It's managing decline, not true growth.
Okay, that's the state. What's the second institution? This one seems more positive. The universal church.
Yes. This emerges from the suffering and the spiritual needs of that alienated internal proletariat. Figures like Christ or Buddha offer a new kind of hope, a spiritual vision that transcends the failing material world.
A different kind of kingdom, maybe.
Right. And this universal church becomes the vessel, the chrysalis, as Toynbee beautifully put it. The old civilization might die physically, but its deepest spiritual insights, its highest religious expression, are preserved within this church to potentially seed the next civilization.
So in a way, the whole point of the civilization, its ultimate purpose, wasn't its empire or its roads, but the spiritual legacy it produced.
That's a huge part of his argument. The material is scaffolding for the spiritual, and the third product of decay is simply the end game.
The barbarian invasions.
When the external proletariat finally breaks through the weakened defenses, they are essentially just taking over a body that was already dying from internal causes, the vultures arriving, as you said earlier.
Okay, let's pull back and look at the big themes here. Connect them to us today. The first big one seems to be shifting focus from fate to agency.
Absolutely. It's a powerful message of choice. History isn't just predetermined by where you live or what resources you have. Progress comes from how we choose to respond to difficulties. If we choose comfort, avoid challenges. Well, decay is the likely outcome.
And the second theme, that idea of etherealization, really challenges how we define progress, doesn't it? Especially in the West, we tend to equate progress with, you know, faster technology, economic growth, GDP.
Right. But if Toynbee's right, and true growth is this internal spiritual cultural refinement, how do we even measure that? In our data-obsessed world, how do we gauge the real health of our society?
It forces you to ask different questions. Are we just building, I don't know, better drones? Or are we building better communities, better ethics?
A society totally focused on the material risks becoming just a hollow universal state, powerful but brittle.
Which leads to the third major theme, the huge moral warning about leadership.
Yeah. The health of the whole civilization really hinges on the moral and creative quality of its leaders. The second that leadership stops inspiring voluntary followership and starts relying on control and coercion, the clock is ticking.
That shift from creative minority to dominant minority is the alarm bell.
It's the critical signal of decline. Are people following willingly, out of inspiration, or out of fear and obligation?
Speaking of signals, Toynbee condensed his ideas into some really memorable lines. Let's touch on a few key ones. The first is probably the most famous summary.
Civilizations are not murdered, but take their own lives. It just cuts through all the excuses, doesn't it? The responsibility lies within. External enemies are just symptoms or consequences of that prior internal failure, moral, spiritual, creative failure.
Powerful stuff. And the second one really elevates the whole historical process, giving it a deeper meaning. The supreme accomplishment of a dying civilization is to serve as the chrysalis for a new universal religion.
That points to the ultimate purpose, in his view. History isn't just cycles of power. It's a process that facilitates spiritual discovery. The pain and struggle of a collapsing society actually create the conditions for a higher truth to emerge and last.
And the third one gets right back to that leadership dynamic. The creative minority wins the voluntary allegiance of the mass. Not by the fear of its weapons.
It just draws that line so clearly. Inspiration versus coercion. Vitality versus decay. If leaders in government, in business, anywhere have to rely on force or complex rules rather than genuine vision, that voluntary buy-in is already gone.
And this isn't just abstract history. It feels like you can apply this framework right now. like in organizations?
Oh, definitely. Look at any struggling company or, say, a political party. Is the leadership acting like a dominant minority? Are they bogged down in bureaucracy, enforcing old rules rather than fostering innovation and taking risks?
Are they losing their best people, their internal proletariat?
Exactly. If talented, motivated people are leaving because they feel alienated or uninspired, that's Toynbee's breakdown pattern playing out right there.
And on a personal level, too, that withdrawal and return idea.
Yeah, it suggests that if you're facing a really tough, complex personal challenge, maybe the answer isn't just more frantic effort in the middle of the chaos. Maybe you need that step back, that period of quiet reflection, to find the truly creative solution before you re-engage.
Facing challenges, not avoiding them, is the path to growth.
And the biggest application, maybe, is trying to diagnose our own time. Toynbee lived through the world wars. He saw them as the peak of Western civilization's time of troubles. He was deeply worried about unchecked nationalism and militarism.
So the big question for us, using his lens, is where are we now? Are we stuck in the later stages, maybe a kind of universal state phase with gridlock and bureaucracy? Or are we finding genuinely creative, unifying responses to today's massive challenges? Climate change, AI, global inequality. Our future kind of depends on the answer.
For me, the most valuable takeaway is that history isn't this fixed, deterministic cycle. Toynbee showed us the patterns, yes, but they aren't prophecy. We still have agency.
The choices still matter.
Absolutely. The fate of our civilization, or any group really, rests on its ongoing ability to respond creatively and morally to whatever challenges come its way. It doesn't matter how many times the pattern has played out before, the next response can still be different.
And what surprised me most, diving back into this, was just how radically he prioritized that spiritual or cultural outcome. The empires, the technology, they're ultimately less important than the chrysalis. The lasting measure of success isn't power, but the vitality and wisdom passed on.
So if challenge and response really is the fundamental law, here's a final thought to leave you with. What do you think is the single biggest challenge facing your civilization, your community right now? And perhaps more importantly, are the leaders you see responding to it acting like a creative minority or a dominant minority?
Something to really ponder.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.